Afternoon, this case is Ovail, is that the?
It's Ovail, Your Honor.
Ovail?
Yes.
Sorry, thank you. And is that Mr. Ovail?
That is Mr. Ovail.
How are you, sir?
Very good.
Okay. Ovail versus State, case 78084, counsel ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, go ahead then, Mr. Schoenfeld.
May please the Honorable Court, Richard Schoenfeld, appearing on behalf of the appellant Michael Ovail, who is present. With the court's permission, I'd like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to focus on, with the court's permission, two of the issues that really, when taken in conjunction, give this Honorable Court an opportunity to send a message to the state of Nevada that misconduct won't be tolerated when it infringes upon the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial. The first issue is found in the opening brief at issue number 4. And that issue is when Ms. Luzich in voir dire, and putting this in context, we are in the infancy stages of the trial, haven't exercised peremptory challenges, I haven't even started my questioning of the jury. So we've had a couple of hours of the court asking the general voir dire, and then Ms. Luzich gets her opportunity before I have mine, and she says to one of the jurors, tell us about your experience on the last jury. Did you enjoy that experience? Or did you find it interesting? And in response, the juror said, interesting it was, but it was very difficult to make a decision that I knew could put the person in prison for life. And Ms. Luzich responded, oh, well, the penalty in this case is nothing like that. I immediately objected. As this court is well aware, it is way outside the jury's province to be able to consider punishment. And the problem with that statement, number one, it was made by the prosecutor. Number two, it was to the entire veneer panel. So every single juror that ended up on Mr. Ovalle's jury heard that comment, which left the impression that a conviction would be insignificant. The conviction in this case was far from insignificant. Mandatory prison time, felony conviction, loss of rights to a firearm, and loss of a career as a decorated police officer. So to leave the jury with the impression of insignificance was completely inappropriate.
Didn't the court instruct the jury on that point? Wasn't there an objection, an approach, and the court instructed the jury? Why wasn't that instruction sufficient to cure that problem?
Immediate objection, immediate motion for mistrial, again, at the infancy stages. The curative instruction was not sufficient because every single juror heard it, and it was the prosecutor who made the statement. So simply telling the jury, disregard, you're not allowed to consider punishment, was not enough. And when we look at the cases that are cited by the state, Ledbetter, Jeffries, in both of those cases, the court made a point of recognizing that it was not the prosecutor who opened the door to the statement. In this case, the prosecutor didn't just open the door, the prosecutor is the one who caused the juror misconduct based on that statement. The Jeffries case, the court specifically stated that the defense lawyer opened the door to the comment, and on top of that, they stipulated to the curative instruction. And that's why this is different than that case. Similar, Ledbetter, it was the defense lawyer that created the comment. It was not the prosecutor or the plaintiff's attorney in that case. Here, it was the prosecutor who volunteered and expressly stated, used the word penalty. Oh, in this case, the penalty is nothing like that. And then when we look at the cases that I cited from federal court, for example, U.S. versus Meredith, 824 F. 2nd, 1418, which is Fourth Circuit, which in that case cites to U.S. versus Greer, a Tenth Circuit case, at 620 F. 2nd, 1383, the courts have recognized over and over again the inherent prejudice with the type of statement that was given in this case. And in one of those cases, what the court said is that when you leave the jury with the impression that a conviction would be inconsequential, it lowers the burden of proof on the part of the prosecution because the jury says to themselves, well, even if we find this person guilty, it's inconsequential. So they don't follow the actual burden of proof, knowing that a conviction has real significance, and in this case, had very real significance. My client was remanded to custody upon entry of the verdict, and again, I've already discussed the other consequences other than just mandatory prison time. So there were real consequences. When we take this issue in conjunction with the Golden Rule violations, and this issue standing alone is enough to establish that there was prejudice and that my client didn't receive a fair trial. But when you take it in conjunction with the two additional misconduct violations of the Golden Rule violations, it becomes really clear that in this very short duration trial, my client did not have a fair trial. And what was that issue? This court is aware that at this trial, my client was charged with battery domestic violence by strangulation. The alleged victim told her mother and her sister that Mr. Ovalle had done it. As soon as the police came that evening, she said, I had lied to my mom and my sister because I was really mad at Michael because he left me when we were in Las Vegas on vacation on the strip where I was in a circumstance that I got into a fight with a stranger in front of O'Shea's.
Didn't she also, though, tell them, like, two weeks later, she also reiterated that this occurred?
I believe 2 weeks later she made a statement. I don't think she made a statement saying that it had occurred, but there was a statement regarding some act between her and Michael, Your Honor, but I don't know for certain. But there definitely, it was the mother, and there definitely was testimony regarding a second statement when she spoke to the mother.
Right, like 2 weeks later or something,
yes.
She reiterated that it happened.
Yes, there was. But as to this point, it really, those statements aren't the issue that would cause a reversal. What causes the reversal is putting into context that her statement is, I was in front of O'Shea's, got into a fight with a stranger. It wasn't Michael. I just told my mom and sister that it was because I was mad. So now we take the Golden Rule violation in closing argument. And here's what's said. And this is at Appellant's Appendix 1112. Now, a battery domestic violence case, we talked about this in voir dire. It's different than a regular case. If you are walking down the street and someone punches you in the face and takes your wallet, you are not going to feel probably very conflicted about what you want to do, right? You're going to want to tell the police. You're going to want to prosecute. So what they are doing there is, first, a Golden Rule violation, and the district court found it to be one. But what they are doing there is telling the jury, put yourself in the shoes of Crystal. If she really got into a fight with a stranger in front of O'Shea's, she would have called the police, because that's what you would do. She would have reported it. She would have prosecuted it, because that's what you would do. And the fact that she didn't report it to the police and didn't prosecute it tells you that she's lying to you. So it's a Golden Rule violation and, in some respects, vouching. So then we take the second part of the same violation. You have probably been physically, emotionally, financially hurt by this person. You do not know that you have no connection to. But battery domestic violence is different, much more complicated, because the person who is hurting you, the person who is doing these horrible things to you, is the person that's supposed to love you and protect you and care for you. But they are the person who is making you feel in a negative way. So this is the second part, two Golden Rule violations in one kind of theme. What they are saying here is that Crystal took the stand and lied to you because you know that if you get battered by someone you love, you may feel conflicted and therefore lie. So the Golden Rule violation goes to the two aspects of the theory of defense in this case. But then the judge, sua sponte, as I'm about to object, raises the Golden Rule violation, calls us to the bench, and says, admonishes the prosecutor that it's a Golden Rule violation. Don't do it again. Later on, because the bench conferences aren't recorded, I make my record that I was going to object, and then there's a second Golden Rule violation, and I move for a mistrial. So now we get to Golden Rule violation number two after the prosecutor has been admonished that that was a Golden Rule violation. And here's what they say. And this one is in reference to the first interaction that Crystal has after getting back to the hotel and going to the room is with Julian Robles, who was the appellant's law enforcement partner, who's been there with them. She sees him and doesn't tell him that I got into a fight with someone in front of O'Shea's. That puts this into context. Here's the statement. She didn't remember her body being grabbed when she was testifying on the stand, and I brought up the comment that she made to Deputy Robles. Suddenly, maybe her body was grabbed by a man, and she just kind of forgot to mention that part. I would submit to you, that seems like a pretty big deal. That seems like it would be something maybe you would remember. Again, court found it to be a Golden Rule violation, but denied my motion for a mistrial. And when we look at the Leosi case, what it says there is that when there are multiple Golden Rule violations, there is a heightened probability of prejudice. And what it also says, which is significant here, is that once the lawyer who causes the Golden Rule violation has been admonished, they then assume the risk of the granting of a motion for new trial when they make a repeated Golden Rule violation. In this case, I moved for a mistrial and later had a motion for a new trial based on this. So contemporaneous with the conduct, I moved for a mistrial. When you take those three violations that fall within the category of misconduct, in this small, short trial, it is clear that Deputy Ovalle, the appellant, did not receive a fair trial that he was entitled to, and this court has the opportunity to once again admonish the state to respect the defendant's constitutional rights and afford a fair trial. And with that, I'll reserve my remaining time.
I'm going to give you some additional time, Sean Pelt,
okay,
on this question, and I'll give additional time to the state as well. Could you walk through for me the disputes surrounding what was alleged to be the improper service of Crystal with a subpoena and your perspective on that? I'd like to hear the state's as well.
Yes. So when we look at the statute regarding material witness subpoenas for somebody who is from out of state, the Nevada statute, let me find it, just in one second.
Because my understanding is both the witness and Mr. Ovalle challenged this.
Yes. And we challenged it because it is a procedural due process right. Under NRS 174.425, the statute requires, in order to command a witness from out of state to appear within this state, that a certificate of materiality first be obtained. When we look at the statute and the procedure for issuing a certificate of materiality under NRS 174.425, it requires a hearing where the court finds that the person is in fact a material witness. That is the part that did not occur here.
Did it occur though in California? Generally, they occur in the other state.
No, it didn't occur in the other state. What happened, and I also cited the California statute, what happened is the certificate was issued here ex parte. It was then served in California on Crystal. And what they served her with is in the appendix. It gives her the opportunity to go to court where the court would a second time determine whether or not she's a material witness. But the prerequisite is the Nevada certificate. Or she could waive that and agree to appear. So her counsel appeared for her the day before trial in support of the motion and said that she did sign a waiver, but she didn't know what she was signing. And the judge didn't conduct an evidentiary hearing on that point. And essentially, as it relates to the failure to have a hearing before issuing a certificate of materiality, made a finding that, oh, well, she's the victim, so she's material. But the statute was absolutely violated because it's a requirement that before a certificate be issued, there be a hearing, and no hearing occurred. And in conjunction with that, the court did not consider that the waiver that was entered into was, in fact, a knowing, voluntary, intentional waiver. But it was already defective at that point because there had been no proper Nevada certificate of materiality issued.
So then at the hearing where Crystal's lawyer raised this question, the judge entered an order denying Crystal's objection. Is that what you're saying?
Denied my motion. I believe I filed
a your motion or Crystal's motion?
It was a joint motion on behalf of Appellant Ovalle and Crystal Quinonez.
Okay.
To, I believe, quash service and not mandate her appearance.
Her motion, focusing only on her, her motion was denied.
Yes, it was. And the judge also deemed that she didn't have a Fifth Amendment privilege that she could invoke at that point in time either.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll add a minute and a half to your time, and you can proceed then, Ms. Craig.
Thank you. May it please the Honorable Court, Genevieve Craigs for the state. And I'm going to start by addressing the request that you just made of Mr. Schoenfeld about the procedural issues with the motion to compel the witness from out of state. We made this argument below as well, Justices, that the defendant does not have standing to even make this argument.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Is his description of the facts correct? Was there no certificate in the first instance?
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The state presented to the district court judge a certificate that was signed by that district court judge I don't believe that that actual certificate, along with an affidavit that was signed by myself as well, was actually part of the record. My understanding is that part of Appellant's Appendix, and I have that down as Appellant's Appendix 155 through 158, was the actual subpoena and information from California to Ms. Quinones that she signed, the subpoena from Nevada, and then also the waiver that she signed from California and Nevada saying that she would waive her right to that hearing in California. But also part of that, and I believe that in the record, Mr. Schoenfeld says that he was provided a copy of that, there was a certificate that the district court judge signed that talked about the witness being a material witness. And as part of that, there was an affidavit that I signed that also said, and I said as an officer of the court, that the witness was in fact a material witness. I also believe that in the...
Even though it's not a part of the appendix, that was provided to the trial judge when these motions were made?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's a part of this... Part of the record anyway in this case.
I believe so, yes. And I believe Mr. Schoenfeld makes a comment in Appellant's Appendix. I don't remember where it is, but it's in that area where he does state that he was given a copy of that certificate. Mm-hmm. He was not given a copy, obviously, the original one that the judge signed, but a copy of what that language was. But I did not see that as part of Appellant's Appendix. And I don't believe we provided that to you either. But I can tell you that there was an actual certificate that the court did sign, that there was an affidavit from myself that the court also looked at. And then that was part of what then I sent over to a deputy district attorney in L.A. County, who I had contact with, who helps to handle these kinds of matters. We made sure that he had all the information he needed, and then he brought it to a judge in L.A. County, who then issued their own subpoena as well. And that's when Ms. Quinones signed both a California waiver of her right to a hearing in California, and then the waiver saying that she would promise to appear here in Nevada for the trial as well.
Thank you.
But again, Your Honors, as a preliminary matter, you know, we did argue below, and we do feel that this is not an appropriate claim for the defendant to be bringing. There is a conflict of interest in this case, clearly. It's a domestic violence case. As the justices are well aware, the victim was not cooperative with the prosecution, hence the motion to compel at the preliminary hearing stage and the motion to compel at the trial stage. At the preliminary hearing stage, and this is part of the record, we elicited from the victim at that time that she had actually driven out to the state of Nevada for the preliminary hearing with the defendant. And then there's motions filed at the trial court level saying, you know, joint with the defense and with the victim, you know, basically challenging her service. And my point is, Justice, is that the appellant doesn't have any rights to assert in this matter. The victim has rights to assert here. She asserted those rights. The district court disagreed with her, and then we moved forward with testimony. There is in the record that the district court did, when the motion was argued, and that's Appellant's Appendix 169, the district court judge did make a finding that she was a material witness. Additionally, in one of the cases, I believe it's Bell v. State, which is a Nevada case from 1994, this court actually talked about how there was a mistake made by the district court judge because the preliminary hearing testimony clearly showed that the witness in that case that the defendant wanted to compel from out of state, that preliminary hearing testimony showed that they would have been material to the defense. My point is that the only issue in the petition for writ of habeas corpus was regarding the testimony of the victim. So the district court judge had read that preliminary hearing testimony from the victim, had read the preliminary hearing testimony from the sister and the mother as well, and had all of the information necessary based on that testimony to make the finding that that was in fact material. We would also take issue with the fact that appellant saying that Ms. Quinones didn't understand what she was signing. Your Honors, we went through this process twice, and both times Ms. Quinones was represented by counsel. The first time we did it in preliminary hearing, it was the same set of documentation. I went through the same deputy district attorney in Los Angeles County, and the same folks, I believe, served her with that waiver, and she had an attorney. When we came around for trial, she had that same attorney. My understanding is he was out of the jurisdiction, so a different attorney stepped in, but she was represented. It was the exact same procedure. She signed that waiver again, and we were also in contact as the state, in contact with her attorney, letting her attorney know, you know, we're going to be serving these documents because it was around Thanksgiving, and we would like her to be here on this date. So as a preliminary matter, we don't believe they have standing, but we also believe that we followed the procedure appropriately. A finding of materiality was made, and she did voluntarily sign that waiver. And I move on to the discussion that Mr. Schoenfeld had with the court about the two alleged prosecutorial misconduct instances. In the appellant's opening brief.
I'm sorry, before you go on.
Yes.
I get your argument about standing, but you wouldn't suggest that a defendant can't challenge an erroneously entered, not saying that happened here, but an erroneously entered order requiring a witness to testify in a trial. Can a defendant challenge the propriety of the underlying proceedings that brings a witness to the court?
Your Honor, I think in certain circumstances potentially, but in this circumstance, it's particularly...
You've made the record and your view of it, but I want to speak more generally, hypothetically.
Yes.
If I'm a defendant in a case and a witness has been brought before the court without the following of those procedures, why can't I object to that witness testifying?
Your Honor, I think that potentially you could.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could point out that all of the published case law has been regarding defendants actually essentially appealing the fact that the district court refused to compel witnesses from out of state for their defense, I think that makes sense because they have obviously the defense has the right to assert their defense. To me, this court has considered situations like that because that makes more sense.
Okay, let's move on.
I'm sorry.
Too much of your time.
So in terms of appellant's opening brief, there is discussion about the comment made by the state in voir dire. I found it a little bit confusing. I think there are two sort of separate things that are discussed. The first is the motion for mistrial, and then the second is a motion for a new trial. The standards are kind of interwoven in the opening brief. The motion for mistrial, I would submit to the court, should be considered under an abusive discretion standard. And we should be using the test put forth by this court in Valdez v. State, written by Justice Hardesty. And that is a two-pronged test for prosecutorial misconduct. Obviously, the first was the conduct improper, and then the second is, does it warrant reversal? And I would contend, firstly, that the conduct was not improper, and secondly, that it certainly does not warrant reversal if this court finds that it was improper.
If we find it improper, what's your argument against cumulative error on all three of the misconducts that
I understand, Your Honor. And regarding cumulative error, there has to be, I guess the test under Valdez v. State is the issue of guilt close, the quantity and character of the error, and the gravity of the crime charged. To start with the quantity and character of the error, I would obviously disagree with Mr. Schoenfeld's characterization. Under the test regarding Valdez, I don't think that either. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I guess you said if we assume that you find them improper, the Golden Rule arguments were not constitutional error, is what I would argue, and neither was the comment made in voir dire. Neither of those situations implicate the defendant's constitutional rights.
Do you think they're proper, though?
I would argue...
Would you say that they are not Golden Rule violations?
Your Honor, and I'm the one who gave the closing argument, and I would say that I understand that it was inartfully phrased. I do agree to that. However, the use of the word you was rhetorical. It wasn't to inflame the passions of the jury. It wasn't to try to prejudice the jury. It was at the very beginning of my closing argument, and I was not discussing... or saying, put yourself in the victim's shoes, she should have gone to the police, you would have done that, X, Y, and Z. It was a discussion of the motives of the witnesses in the case, because it's a little bit more complicated than, as I was trying to get across, and as I said, the use of the word you, I should have said an individual, or someone, or a hypothetical person. It's not like a robbery when a stranger comes and hits you in the face. There's no complicated emotions there. But when it's somebody that's supposed to love an individual, then that is when things get a little bit more complicated. So if you look, and I believe it's Byers talks about how statements that a prosecutor makes should be considered in the context that they're made. And I think if you look at the context in which I was making these statements, it wasn't in order to put the jury in the victim's shoes, in a witness's shoes. It was simply to try to explain the difference in a domestic violence case of this nature versus a typical case where maybe you don't know the individual that's hurting you. See, I did it again. You don't know the person that is hurting, the victim in the case. So that would be my contention, is that the Golden Rule violations were not actually Golden Rule violations, that they were not improper. But if you do find that they were improper, I certainly don't think that they're constitutional violations. They certainly don't inject, and let me make sure I get this correct, they certainly don't infect the trial with unfairness as to make the resulting conviction a denial of due process. They would be considered non-constitutional errors, which then it would only be reversal if the error substantially affected the jury's verdict. So that would be my argument against cumulative error. And I would point to Valdez v. State as an example of when this court has overturned because of cumulative error. A few of those violations in that case were that the prosecutor said something like during voir dire, I don't think anyone in this room is okay with killing kids except for maybe one person. There was that. There were a couple of other issues, but then there was also issues with the jury actually coming back from the guilt phase and saying they were prepared to sentence the defendant at that point. My recollection of what this court said is that, you know, based on what the prosecutor did in terms of that misconduct, plus the issue with the lack of bifurcation and lack of instruction from the district court and what the jury did, that altogether created a cumulative error. And I would argue that because none of this is constitutional error, if the court would find these comments to be improper, we certainly don't rise to the level that this court has used in terms of overturning other cases due to the cumulative error standard. And if I could also just go back briefly to the voir dire comment, I did just want to point out that during voir dire, if you look just a page earlier on Appellant's Appendix 302, the state is talking to prospective juror number 121. And this is the juror right before prospective 122 when the comment was made. And the state at that point, when a juror said, and then, you know, that's going to kind of decide the punishment or whatever, the state said, now remember that if there is to be punishment, if there's a guilty verdict, it's going to be the judge who deals with that. I mean, you as a jury will never have to deal with punishment. That was said just minutes, the person prior to when this other comment was made. So if the court finds that the comment was improper, not only did the state say at least once, if not more times, that punishment was not to be considered by the jury, but then, as the justice pointed out, the court then immediately made an oral curative instruction, and then, of course, there was also the written jury instruction regarding punishment at Appellant's Appendix 1218. So at least three separate times, the jury heard that punishment was not to be considered, and under Ledbetter, it is presumed that jurors will follow their instructions. And if I can move on, unless the justice have any questions for me about the alleged misconduct. Okay. Also part of this discussion about voir dire was a motion for a new trial that was made by the defense. And there's no argument here that it was filed within the 7 days that's required by the statute. But the state did argue in our response, and we still do believe that the motion for a new trial was appropriately denied. But we do also believe that it was not actually appropriately made because it was made under NRS 176.5154, which is the other grounds section of that statute. And this court has found, in two separate cases at least, Washington v. State and Evans v. State, that other grounds portion does apply to when a trial judge finds that the evidence of guilt is conflicting, and after an independent evaluation, the evidence disagrees with the jury's verdict. There has never been an expansion of what those other grounds are, and the case that's cited in the opening brief is Jeffers v. State, which Mr. Schoenfeld discussed briefly. But again, that's not a motion for a new trial brought within the 7 days regarding juror misconduct. That was a motion for mistrial regarding juror misconduct. And therefore, I didn't see any sort of precedent that allows for a filing for motion for a new trial unless it has to do with this very specific thing that the court has found in Washington and in Evans. And if I could just briefly talk about the first issue, unless the court has questions for me on those issues. The first issue was the denial of the petition for a writ of habeas corpus. The state obviously believes the district court correctly denied the motion, did not abuse their discretion, and that the state appropriately followed all of the requirements of the hearsay statute, as well as of Crowley and of Richard v. State, which came out about 2 months after the preliminary hearing was held. The state had the victim on the stand. She said that she remembered the conversation she had with her mother and her sister, that she remembered saying that, yes, Deputy Ovalle did this to me, but that she didn't remember the specifics of anything that she had said. And as was said that you should do in Richard v. State, then the state went through and asked her every single specific thing that it wanted to get out based on her prior statements. Do you remember telling your mother that he choked you? Do you remember telling your mother that you were so scared you thought you were going to die? And we went through each and every one of those statements. And in the opening brief, appellant tries to distinguish. Oh, I have another minute and a half. Is that correct?
You had that at the beginning.
Okay.
And you are there.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You want to just, I assume you want us to affirm the conviction.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Grace.
Going back to the certificate of materiality issue, if we take a look at the Fouquet case, 67 Nevada 505, I'm going to read from page 516 where the court says, obviously this does not mean that all persons are material witnesses who are so designated by either party or because they might possibly give pertinent evidence at trial. Whether the witnesses are material can only be determined by the judge after a hearing. Two important points there. One, there was no hearing to determine materiality.
It was an ex parte affidavit.
Ex parte affidavit.
Are you aware of the, I'm going to say it wrong, Bougeon case where Justice Pickering, there is, you're not.
Not
well, it was basically by ex parte affidavit. And I believe under that opinion that Justice Pickering had authored one that said that that was a hearing for purposes.
If it was.
An exception to Markham.
Oh, under Markham.
An exception to Markham for material witnesses. Right.
Well, the other issue that I would raise here, and I obviously will look at that case, is that clearly based on that language in Fouquet, the parties are entitled to a hearing, necessitates that the parties can object. So to suggest that my client didn't have standing to object to the issuance of a certificate of materiality is negated by the clear case law from this court.
How is she not a material witness if she's the victim in this case and based on what the overall testimony is? How is she not material even to the state?
You know what, Your Honor, there was no hearing on it, and obviously, you know, I'm not going to say that they could prove their case without her. But the problem is that the statute was violated. There was no hearing. Then they take it to California where she has the similar statutory ability. They acknowledge that they bring it to her without her counsel present. She signs a waiver. Her counsel files a motion saying that she didn't sign the waiver knowing and voluntarily. And the judge says, well, you know what? She's the victim, so she must be material. I'm compelling her to be here. So the process wasn't followed. Definitely a statutory violation. I don't think that I'm in a position to argue that she wasn't material to the state. And that's what the court ultimately found, no harm, no foul. I just don't know that that's the proper approach when there's a clear statutory violation compelling a witness from another state into this one. I know that I am short on time, if I may. Oh, the last thing I'll say is with the cumulative error, first of all, I think it's very disingenuous for the respondent to now argue if the comment regarding penalty was in fact improper. There's no question under the law you're not allowed to talk about penalty with the jury. That's just black letter law. And it was said to the jury and it was improper. So really the question is whether or not it's error. This is not an overwhelming evidence case by any means. So to have that type of cumulative error in this case, three statements of misconduct, no overwhelming evidence, it clearly meets the standard of cumulative error. And with that, I will submit and ask that the court reverse the conviction.
Okay.